what they would say, because deep in my heart I was neither mystified nor confused as to what had come, for I well knew the price for what we put upon Georgie Parks. What I found then was what I expected. There in the shadow of Ryland's jail, which itself seemed to contain half the life left in Starfall, Freetown was in ruins. But not the kind that now afflicted the rest of Starfall. The shanties were nearly destroyed, and what remained were wooden planks black from burning, ashes, and among those structures still standing, doors torn off hinges as though crashed in by some tremendous force. Such was the home of Georgie Parks. I walked in and saw that everything was smashed, the bed broken in two, a chest of drawers axed down the middle, the shards of pottery, a pair of spectacles. I stood there for a few moments, taking in the fruit of my ways, the harvest of the underground's terrible revenge, which had not merely vented itself on Georgie Parks, but on the entirety of Freetown. And I felt a deep and pervading shame. That was when I saw it, in the corner, a small toy horse, which I had given to Georgie on the birth of his child. I bent down to pick up the horse, and then walked back outside. It was now early evening. Ryland's jail stood a block away in a stony silence. The sun was falling over the trees in the distance. I felt a gray menace blowing up from the abandoned street. I put the toy horse in my coat pocket and walked on. Part 3. The Negroes, in the meantime, who had gotten off, continued dancing among the waves, yelling with all of their might what seemed to me a song of triumph. Alexander Falconbridge. Chapter 28. The following afternoon, I took the horse and chaise from the stables, and out of Starfall, steering away from the Stone Bridge, Dumb Silk Road, and the Falling Creek Turnpike, for the proper way back to Lochless. I was drowning in a bleed of feelings, and what bled most was not the proposed meeting with my father, was not shame at my last words for Thina, was not even the sight of Sophia. All of that was there, but reigning high above it all was a deep-seated and boyish hope that the decay that I could now see had overrun Elm County had somehow spared my Lochless. Who knows why we love what we do? Why we are what we are? I tell you, I was by then mortgaged to the underground. All that I knew of true humanity, of allegiance and honor, I had learned in that last year. I believed in the world of Kesia and Harriet and Raymond and Otha and Mars. Still, the boy in me had not died. I was what I was and could no more choose my family, even a family denied me, than I could choose a country that denies us all the same. But when I turned off the West Road into Lochless, I understood almost immediately that my wish would not be granted. Like the raceway, the main road had begun to submit to the growth of the forest. And then I rode farther, past the fields, and saw that the regular team had shrunk in number, and looking out at them, I recognized no one. A hint of hope came from the apple orchards, closer to the main house, which seemed perfectly maintained and did not smell of fruit left to rot on the ground. And better than even the apple orchards was the garden of late asters just before the main house. I pulled the chaise up to the stables, tied the horse, and noticed that there was now but one horse, save the one I'd just driven, in the stable. My horse was thirsty and panting. I carried the trough over to the spring, filled it with water, and set it down in the stable. And when I looked into the water, it shimmered a bit, shimmered for me. Soon come, I thought. Then I began my walk to the White Palace of Lochless. I saw him before he saw me. I was standing at the end of the road just before the main house. He was seated on the porch behind the bug blind in his hunting clothes, with his rifle at one side and his afternoon cordial in the other. I had in my hand a crate of gifts sent along by Corrine. It was almost evening. The autumn sun was just beginning to fall. I stood there and watched for a moment, and then I called out, "Good afternoon, sir." I saw him awake, blink, and when he understood, his eyes were as wide as full moons. He did not so much run as he swam out into the road with bizarre abandon, his arms flailing the air like water. He pulled me close, right into an embrace, right there in the full open, and the old savage smell of him was all over me. "My boy," he said, and then he stepped back to look at me, holding both shoulders, soft tears streaming down his face. "My boy," he said again, shaking his head. I do not know what manner of reception I imagined on returning to my father's house. Memory was my power, not imagination. But then, there was my father himself, and when he guided me up to the front porch and we were seated, I was able to take the measure of him. He seemed to have become the town of Starfall in miniature. I had been gone but a year, and in that time he seemed to have aged 10. He was weaker. His severe features had softened, and his whole body seemed to sag into his chair. There were coin sacks under his eyes, and his face was discolored and pocked. I felt his heart working for every beat. But there was something else, a kind of joy in him at my return, a joy that I had glimpsed in him all those years ago when I'd caught the rotating coin in my hand while never breaking my gaze. "By God," he said, looking me over, "we can dress you a sight better than that. Dignity, son. Remember old Roscoe? Polished as a piano, God rest his sorrowful soul." "Yes, sir," I said. "Glad to see you, son. Been too much time. Much, too much time." "Yes, sir." "How you find Miss Corrine's place, boy?"
"Fine, sir."
"Not too fine, I'm hoping."
"Sir?" "Hasn't she told you, son? You are back here at Lochless. How's that strike you?"
"Strikes me very well."
"Good. Good. Let's see what you've got there."
I helped him rummage through the gifts Corrine had sent. A collection of treats and candy, other odds and ends, including a volume of Sir Walter Scott. The supper hour was now upon us, and so I helped my father upstairs, and then into his evening dining clothes.
"Very good. Very good," he said. "You are a natural at it, but get yourself changed. I think old Roscoe was smaller than you. I'm thinking you could outfit yourself in some of Maynard's old garments. That boy had more finery than he could put to use. Miss him, though, I do. Damn, that boy was trouble."
"A good man, sir."
"Yes, he was, but no use in garments gone to seed. Make something distinguished of yourself up there, boy. You may take your brother's old quarters in the house, not down in those tunnels below."
"Yes, sir."
One thing, boy. So much has changed round here since you have gone. The old place cannot be what it was. We lost so many. But I have done as I could, and what I did otherwise could not have been helped. Son, I am old, but all I can think of now in this time is ensuring some kindly air for the place and for our people. I want you to know that is a particular concern to me, do you understand?"
"Yes, sir."
"It was not right of me to let you go, boy. I was in grief. And that girl Corrine, well, she talked me right out of your name. But since you've been gone, I have been at her to bring you back to where I know you want to be. And by God, I have done it. You are here, boy. I know you will feel quite well for old Roscoe, as you did for my little May. But I need you to be more. Once you was hands, son. I got plenty of those. What I now need is your eyes. All got to stay in order. Can I count on you for that, boy?"
"Yes, sir," I said.
"Good. Good. I am a conflicted man. I cannot help it. Two mistakes I made in my life. First was letting go of your mama. Second was letting go of you. And it was all done in a horrible fit. No more. I am an old man, but I am, too, a new one." So that evening, I found myself installed in my dead brother's room and in my dead brother's clothes. And when it was time for supper, I went out to the kitchen and did not recognize a one of them. There was a staff of two working there, down from five, and they were both elderly, which itself said something of the straits Lochless now navigated. Because they produced no children, nor many working years, elderly slaves were the cheapest to acquire. They had, by their own intelligence, heard of that Ryland business, but they seemed oddly pleased that my father seemed so pleased with me, and spoke at length of my father's pride and regret, despite my having run. I think now they thought, perhaps prayed, that I would prove some manner of stabilizing force on the house. I served supper, terrapin soup and chops, and cleaned up with the staff, then took my father to his study with an evening cordial. With that completed, it was now upon me to come face to face with my shame. I left my father sitting there, stripped down to his shirt sleeves and tartan vest, lost in dreams of Lochless Yore, and slid between the wall of the study until I was in the secret staircase that descended into the warrens below. So many were now gone, and where there once had been life, I found an emptiness, a haunt, in all the abandoned quarters, with their doors left open and various odds and ends, wash-basins, marbles, spectacles, left behind. Walking in the warrens, peering by the lantern light, running my hand across the cobwebbed door-frames of the people I'd known, of Cassius, of Ella, of Pete, I felt a great rage, not simply because I knew that they had been taken, but because I knew how they had been taken, how they had been parted from each other, how I was born and made by this great parting. Better than before, I understood the whole dimensions of this crime, the entirety of the theft, the small moments, the tenderness, the quarrels and corrections, all stolen, so that men such as my father might live as gods. My old room was just as I left it, washbasin, jars, and bed. But I was not much in the mood to inspect any of that, for I could hear, just next door, a woman humming, and knowing the voice, I slowly walked out of my room, and then to the adjacent room, and pushing the door, which was slightly ajar, I saw Thina there humming to herself, with two pins between her teeth, and a garment in her lap that she was presently darning. I stood waiting there for some moments for her to acknowledge me, and when she did not, I walked over, pulled out a chair, and sat across from where she was seated on the bed. "Thina," I said. She kept humming, but never looked up. I had by then learned the price of my silence, the cost of holding my words as a shield to my heart. I knew what it was to feel that someone you deeply loved was gone from you, and that you would never be able to tell them all that they had meant. But sitting with Thina, who I thought I'd lost, whose volume and character had only been amplified through my knowledge of Kessia, I felt that I now had a second chance, and I resolved not to waste it. "I was wrong," I blurted out. I had no pretense. I did not know how else to be. The feelings of the past year were all so new, and I was still, in so many ways, a boy with no understanding of how such feelings should be born. But I knew that too much had gone unsaid, and our time together could no longer be presumed. "I came here to confess how badly I had spoken to you when I last saw you, how poorly I have treated you. You are all the family I have, more family than anyone who has ever lived in this house." At this, Thina looked up for a moment, then looked back down, still humming. And though there was no compassion in her eyes, indeed, she was cold as ice, I took even her skeptical regard as a measure of progress. "It is not easy for me to say. You have known me all my life. You know it is not easy. But I am sorry. And for so long I have feared that those words would be the last ones I had given to you. And to see you here again, to see you, listen to me, I was wrong. I am sorry." She had stopped humming, and she looked up again and placed the garment, which I now saw was a pair of trousers, down on the bed. Then She took my right hand in both of hers, and she squeezed it tight, all the time looking away from me. And I heard her breathe in deep and then breathe out. Then she released my hand, picked up the garment, and said,
"Hand me that patch of corduroy."
I walked over to the chest of drawers, picked up the patch, and passed it to her. As I did this, I felt something set right in me. My mother was lost to me, this was true. But before me now was one who had lost as I had, who had been joined to me out of that loss, out of that need, and had become my only unerring family at Lochless, just as she had told me. And where I feared she would hold my words against me, what I saw even in her most contrary gestures was a joy at my safe return. I did not need her to smile. I did not need her to laugh. I did not even need her to tell me how much she had loved me. I only needed her, as it happened, to take my hand. "I am upstairs now," I said, "Maynard's old room. Don't love it, but it was what Master Howell say it be. Holler if you need me." And her only answer to this new information was to pick up her humming again. But then as I walked out of the doorway, I heard her say, "Missed supper." I turned back and said, "Missed more than that." I now returned to my old room and gathered a few of my effects, my water jar, my books, my old clothes, and even my old trusty coin was there, undisturbed on the mantel. I stuffed these into my wash basin and walked up the secret back stairs into the study, where I saw my father quietly dozing. I carried my effects up to Maynard's old room and returned to the study. Then I escorted my father up to his room, my arm under his, helped him out of his clothes and under the covers, and bid him good night. The next morning I dressed, tended to my father again, and then drove the chaise into Starfall to retrieve Corrine, Amy, and Hawkins. Corrine and my father lunched and walked the property alone. An hour later they returned, and we served tea. In the evening, after the visiting party had set off, I served my father supper and then went down into the Warrens to see Thina. In another time, the Warrens teemed with humanity, tasking hands moving amongst each other, singing their songs, trading their stories, and venting their complaints, so that they were almost a world unto themselves, and you could, if you tried, forget that you were held there. But now all the human warmth of the early years had drained from the place, and the Warrens were revealed for what they had always been, a dungeon beneath a castle, dank and gray, an effect augmented by the array of lanterns that had fallen into disrepair, and now left long stretches of the Warrens in darkness. When I arrived, Thina was not there. I decided to sit and wait. She arrived a few minutes later, looked at me, and said,
"Evening?"
"Evening," I said.
"You ate?"
"No." We had greens, fatback, and ash cake. We ate silently, as we had always done when I was a child. Then, after cleaning up, I bid Thina good night and returned to my room. We continued this routine for a week, and then one unseasonably warm evening, at my suggestion, we took our plates out to the end of the Warren's tunnel, where I had, all those years ago, entered with her. We sat there, eating, watching the sun set over the country. Thina said,
"So you done seen Sophia?"
"Not yet," I said. Figured she spent most of her time over at Nathaniel's now.
"No," said Thina. "She right down there on the street. Nathaniel almost always in Tennessee now, so ain't too much reason for her to be over there. But he and Howell and Corrine got some sort of arrangement on her. Can't say I understand it, except that she is left there to her business."
"To her business?" I asked.
"Till they figure out what to do with her, I'm guessing. They don't make a habit of sharing such things with me, as you know."
"I should see her," I said.
"Only if you ready," Thina said. "Best not to rush such things. Lot done changed down this way."
The next day was Sunday, my day. I held myself back until the afternoon. Then realizing I must see her sometime, anyway, and feeling I would never be ready, I took my walk down to the street, down to the place of my birth. And much as I had expected, the street too had fallen into disrepair. There were no chickens roaming about, and all the old gardens were overgrown. These were the last days of the section of the vast southern empire that held Virginia as its ancestral seat. And it has been said, the fact of this falling is the fault of its masters, that have the quality adhere to the hollow virtues of old, perhaps this empire would have stretched forth for 1,000 years. But the fall was always ordained, because slavery made men wasteful and profligate, in sloth. Maynard was crude, and this was his greatest crime. In fact, he mirrored so much of the quality, he simply lacked the guile to hide it. The first bite of winter air had blanketed over Elm County, so that I grew wistful of summer Sundays, and that other time when all of my young friends would have been out playing our little games of marbles and tag. Thina told me that Sophia had taken up in that same far cabin at the end of the street where Thina and I had lived in the days following my mother's departure. Looking down the bank of houses, I saw a woman emerge with a small child on her hip. The woman bounced the baby a few times and then looked up and saw me. She gave me a look of puzzled interrogation, nodded an acknowledgment, and walked back inside. I stood there a second waiting, and then the woman stepped out of the cabin again without the baby, and it was only then that it dawned on me that the woman was Sophia. When Sophia stepped back out, she was different. She stood there a few yards away at the far end of the street. Sophia, my Sophia, unsmiling. I did not know what any of it meant. Was she angry with me for leading her to Ryland? Had I dreamt up that whole evening of us out there in Union? Had it all been a childish flirtation between us? Did she now love another? And who was that baby?
"Gonna stand down there all day?" she yelled down at me.
Then she walked back inside. I followed until I was outside Thina's old cabin, and memories of myself appearing before her with only my victuals overran me. But there was not much time for such things, and looking in, I saw Sophia had the baby on her hip again, bouncing her just as she had outside, singing a song. "Hello?" I said.
"Well, hello, Hiram,"
Sophia said. She had a smug look about her, and I could not decide if this was her usual teasing or if it was something deeper. She sat on a chair by the window and then invited me to take a seat, myself, on the bed. The baby was brown, about my complexion, and cooed quietly in Sophia's arms. It was only then that I began to do the math of it all. So much had changed. I must have given some sign of this awareness, perhaps an arched eyebrow or a widening of the eyes, because Sophia sucked her teeth, rolled her eyes, and said,
"Don't worry, she ain't yours."
"I am not worried," I said. "I am not worried about anything anymore." And when I said this, I saw her relax just a bit, though she was trying to maintain that same cool distance she had offered up when I first arrived. She stood and walked to the window, all the time cradling the child. "What is her name?" I asked.
"Caroline," she said,
still looking out the window. "It's a beautiful name."
"I call her Carrie."
"And that is beautiful, too," I said. Now she sat down across from me, but she did not meet my eyes. She focused on the child, but did so in such a way that I knew the child was a pretense for not looking my way.
"I did not think you would come back," she said. "Don't nobody ever come back here. I heard Corrine Quinn had gotten a hold of you. Somebody said you was up in the mountains somewhere, in the salt mines, they said."
"Who is they?" I asked, laughing quietly.
"That ain't funny," she said. "I was worried for you, Hiram. I am telling you, I was terribly scared."
"Well, I wasn't nowhere near no mines. It's true I was in the mountains," I said, "up at Bryston, but Wasn't no mines. Wasn't half bad, in fact. Quite beautiful up there. You should go sometime. And now Sophia laughed herself and said,
And you come back a joker, huh?
Gotta laugh, Sophia, I said. I have learned that you gotta laugh in this life.
Yeah, you do, she said. Though I find it harder every day. Need to think of good things and better times. Do you know I talk about you, High?
Talk about me to who?
To my Carrie. Tell her everything.
Huh, I said. Ain't much else to talk about, it seemed. Place so empty now.
Yeah, said Sophia. So many lost, so many gone. Natchez got them. Tuscaloosa, Cairo, hauled them down into that big nothing. It get worse every day. Long Jerry from over at the McEaster place was by here only 2 weeks ago. I felt surely he was too old for them to take. He was here, right here, with an offering of yams, trout, and apples. Thina even came down. We fried it up and had a good supper together. It was just 2 weeks ago, and now he gone. It's been so many, High, so many. I don't know how they keeping this thing afloat. Was a girl named Millie came through here a few months back. Beautiful girl, which was her loss. She ain't last but a week. Natchez. Fancy trade.
But you still here, I said.
Indeed. Indeed, she said.
Now Caroline began to stir, wriggling in her mother's arms until she could turn her head and get a good solid look at me. And the child held me there with a stare of the deepest of intentions, regarding me in the way infants do when brought before someone unknown. I never knew what to do with that look. It discomforts me. But there was more, because that look, and all its intense study, was the inheritance of her mother. Perhaps it was all the moments I had spent conjuring the face, recreating the particulars. And there was something else now, more math. Caroline had the same sun-drop eyes as her mother, but the color, an uncommon green-gray, came from somewhere else. I knew this because my own eyes were the same color, and the color was a Walker inheritance, given not only to me but to my uncle, Nathaniel. Again, my looks must have betrayed me, because Sophia sucked her teeth, pulled Caroline close, stood and turned away.
Already told you, Sophia said, she ain't yours.
I know now what it is to feel things that you have no right to feel. I knew it even then, though I did not know how to describe it. What I remember was one half of me wanted to get away from Sophia, to never speak to her again, to disappear into the underground and cut away that girl who would not be my Sophia. And then another part, a part of me conceived in my mother's own strife, then reared on the underground, the part that was dazzled by that university of state, that part that found the wisdom to tell Robert that nothing is pure and thank God, was shocked to find such resentment still curdling in me. I watched Sophia watch the baby for a moment, then shifted away and said, So how many of us left?
Don't know, Sophia said. Was never sure how many was here to begin with. And for the sake of my own heart, I stopped counting the departed. Surely these are the last days of Lochless. They are killing us, High. And not just here, across Elm County. They are killing us all.
She sat back down with Caroline.
But you did come back, she said. And you look good for yourself. It has been a blessing of mine to see you return to us, to be reborn twice in a lifetime. Up out of the goose, and now out of the jaws of Ryland. Must be some powerful meaning, for we are not in Natchez, but right here before each other. Some meaning in us, I think. Some powerful, powerful meaning.
But the discovery of that meaning would have to wait. I walked back that evening and tended to my father and his supper. Then I descended into the Warrens and joined Thina for supper. There was no ambient action outside the doors, nor in the house above. It felt like we were all
alone on some far side of the world, and I understood some of how it must have been in the earliest days of Loch Ness, when it was only the progenitor and his team of tasking men, with nature closing in around them. After we finished, we walked outside and sat at the edge of the tunnel to the Warrens. Thina looked over at me and said,
"So you went to see her?"
I looked to the ground and shook my head. Thina laughed to herself. "You could have told me," I said.
"Like you could have told me?"
"Was different then," I said.
"No, the same. You judged it to be no business of mine. I did not agree. But I am struggling to see how telling you that that girl was a grass widow would make me anything more than a gossip. There are things between you two that do not concern me."
She was right. I thought back to that moment when I'd last seen her before running, and I recalled my harsh words, and I knew that while I could apologize for the pain I had caused, the break was real. The child had left home. He could not return. "I'm not even angry with her," I said. "Wasn't ever like she was mine."
"Nope."
Caroline was, by my estimation, perhaps 4 months old, which meant that when I ran with Sophia, she was already carrying the baby. And knowing her intellect and independence and thinking on all our conversations, I understood that she was not simply with child when we ran, but likely ran with me because she was with child. "Thina, I am feeling that she had reasons to run, reasons that she declined to share with me."
"Yep."
"And that has left me with feelings, like I laid myself bare before that girl, and when I ran, I did so giving all of my reasoning, straight down the line."
"Straight down the line, huh?"
"Yep."
"Yeah? All right. Listen, I'm gonna tell you, ain't nobody straight down no line, hi. Least of all two young'uns like y'all two, hot after each other as you was."
"I did not lie," I said.
"Huh, straight down the line," Thina said, shaking her head. "You sure about that? You sure you telling everything? I gotta say, I know I don't feel like I done heard the whole of it. And I would bet my next week's vittles that Sophia ain't either."
Chapter 29 Autumn moved to winter, and our days grew gray and cool, our nights lonesome and blue. In those early days back, I worked as Roscoe once had, though my duties were lighter on account of the diminished number of guests entertained. The old days of Elm County royalty, of parasols and powdered faces, lady cake and card games, the old days when I would amaze whole parties with the magic of memory, were gone. From time to time, older friends, as ancient as my father, would call upon him. They would spend hours denouncing the young quality dazzled by tales of boundless land out west who'd abandoned their Virginian birthright. There was still my uncle, Nathaniel Walker, who held Sophia and somehow maintained himself and all of his land. But his tasking folks had, besides a small team for maintenance, all gone west. Harlan was still there at Loch Ness, pushing the tasking folks to extract all they could from the dying land. But his wife, Desi, no longer ruled the house because the house had so diminished that there was no need for her hand. My father's most constant companion was Corrine, who, no matter Maynard's death, he still held as the daughter he'd never had. She would arrive in full grieving costume driven by Hawkins. She comforted my father. She'd let him regale her with that other age before the yawning fallows when tobacco ever flowing endowed the estates. Still, the duties of everyday companionship mostly fell to me. So every evening after preparing supper for my father and taking mine with Thina, I would tend the fire in the parlor, serve warm cider, and listen to the last true lord of Loch Ness unspool his regrets. We now fell into the oddest arrangement, one that had been my secret wish in my younger years. I tasked for him, but the nature of the relationship so shifted that he would, on those blue evenings, with the argand lamp casting its long shadows against the old family busts, ask that I sit with him and imbibe. And it seemed to me, in those moments, that the whole world had fallen away, fallen into the pit of Natchez, and I alone was left bearing witness. On such an evening as this, finding myself far into the cider, my father spoke of his greatest regret of all, Maynard Walker. At first he seemed to be speaking almost aimlessly, but then his words focused, and out of them came a mourning that was larger than Maynard himself. "My father never loved me," he said. "It was another time, boy. Nothing like today where you see the young folks open and frolicking. My daddy's only concern was station, and all my actions had to honor my lineage. Of course, I married a lady, Lord rest her soul, handsome enough, but she was never the girl I burned for, and she knew that. So when Maynard came, I was set on never putting him in that situation. I wanted him to be what his own nature commanded, so I gave the boy wide berth. Too wide, as it happened. He had no handling. He was not built for society, and I, never loving society myself, did nothing to encourage it. And when his mother passed, well, he was my boy." He paused here. His head was now in his hands, and I sensed he was doing all he could to keep from breaking down and weeping. He pulled his hands away, then stared into the fire for a few long moments. He said, "I almost feel as though May was put out of his misery. I know I was put out of mine. It is a terrible thing to say it, but there was nothing for him here, you see. I had not built him for this life. I had barely been built for it myself. And the young ones are now all headed west. He would have got himself skinned by an Indian or lost everything to swindle. I know it. The boy was not prepared, and that is the fault of me. I'm not a good man, Hiram. You, among them all, know this. I have not forgotten what was done to you." I remember how he was still looking into the fire when he said this. He was as close as he could come to an admission, an apology, for an act I knew but could not then remember. And even as we sat there with our cider, as close as any quality and task in Virginia could be, still he could not look to me and speak with truth. He was as ill-prepared for repentance as Maynard was for mastery. His world, the world of Virginia, was built on a foundation of lies. To collapse them all right then and there at his age might well have killed him. "The land, the management of Negroes, takes a special hand," he said. "It was always beyond me. And what is odd is I always felt that you were the one who had it. You were colder than all of us, colder than Maynard, colder than me, perhaps because of what was done to you. But you had the makings. And I do believe that in some other time our separate acres could be swapped, and perhaps there I might be the colored, and you might be the white." I heard this the way an old man hears a young, unrequited love attest to their true feelings from that bygone era, the mix of trivia and nostalgia, an ancient wound reawakened by the rain, the ghost of a feeling, once deeply held but now only a stray memory from what seemed another lifetime. In this lifetime, I looked over and saw my father now nodding into sleep. I took my glass, still half filled with cider, and walked upstairs to his second-floor study. In the corner, I saw the mahogany highboard, the same one I repaired only a year ago. I took a drink of cider, set it on the windowsill, and then opened the drawers. Inside I found three thick-bound ledgers. For the next hour I slowly pored over these ledgers, committing them to memory.
Together they painted a picture, a grim picture, that would help fulfill my mission, according to Corrine, to ascertain the situation here at Lochless. When I was done, I closed up the ledgers and returned them to the highboy. I thought of Maynard, when we were young, rifling through our father's things. I laughed to myself and then opened a second drawer. Within it, I saw a small but ornate wooden box. I thought to pull the box out and open it, but thinking again of Maynard, I remembered how shameful I felt when he pilfered from our father. So I shut the drawer and walked back downstairs. My father was snoring lightly. I roused him to take him up to bed. He said, "I got plans for you, boy. Plans." I nodded and moved to help him out of his chair, but he looked at me like a man condemned to death, as though he feared that if he slept, he might never again awake. "Tell me a story," he said. "Please, any story." So I withdrew and sat in my own chair, leaned back, and I suddenly felt myself grow old right there, because I saw before me the room come alive with the specters of Cawleys, Mackleys, and Beechams, and all the families of quality who'd once bid of me a story, a song. No, I thought, not far enough. And I, with my words, took my father's hands back through the ages, back to the stone monument in the field, back to the bowie knives, the catamounts and bears, the tasking men hauling stones and breaking creeks, back to the time of our progenitor. The next day, Hawkins drove Corrine over for one of her visits from Starfall, where she had installed herself for some time. Bryston was mostly left to Amy and a few other agents who could keep up the cover. On these visits, I would confer with Hawkins and deliver any intelligence I had discerned, and so it happened on that day. We walked down to the street where the cabins were mostly abandoned, thinking this would provide us the privacy we needed. I maintained a hope of seeing Sophia, though I had begun to keep her at arm's length. I was divided against myself. The intense feelings of only a year ago had not dulled, indeed had grown, so that knowing she was right there at Lochless, but not with me, made me sick. And that sickness scared me, for I now knew that some part of my welfare was in the hands of someone who held her own secret motives and designs.
"So what you think?" Hawkins asked.
We were seated in one of the abandoned cabins closest to the main house and farthest from Sophia's. We could see the tobacco fields, now mostly left to fallow. "Not much," I said. "Not much at all."
"Yeah, I know," Hawkins said, looking over the fields. "Place looked dead."
"The whole county feels dead. Nobody come to see him, no afternoon tea, no big dinners, no socials."
"Yeah? Not sure how Corrine think this gonna fit into anything. Maybe it's good she ain't marry that boy."
"I will tell you this, she would be marrying into a pile of debt." Hawkins looked over at me.
"How much debt?" he asked.
"Well, there ain't been much intelligence to be gleaned from society on account of there being none," I said. "But I got a look at the ledgers last night. He's in over his head. There's an interest on almost every inch of this property. He's stalling, hoping for some relief."
"Well, I'll be," said Hawkins. "Makes sense, I guess. The soil was the wealth, and the soil done gone to dust. My pappy used to tell stories about the land, about how red it was, but they done stripped the place of all the tobacco they could. It's a shame, I tell you. They got as much out of this country as they could, and now haven't gotten it, the whole heap of them headed west."
"And the tasking hands with them," I said.
"Yep. How about the man's brother, Nathaniel? He lendin' a hand?"
"By the looks of them books, he done lent several hands.
Howell ain't paid him nothing back. Blood money after bad money, I guess."
"Huh," Hawkins said.
"Nathaniel's smart. Smart as any man can be in this business. He out Tennessee way now. He moved while the movin' was good. That's the whole game, you know. Eat up the land and keep going. Someday they're gonna run out of land, and I don't know what they'll do then.
We walked back up to the house to meet Corrine. Just before the main drive, Hawkins stopped.
"Something you said back there be turning over in my head," he said. "The man own brother done left him out there, huh?"
"Seems so."
"Stay on them books. Might be something in this."
But there were those who profited in this new arrangement, in the most unlikely ways. Thena now hired herself out, taking in laundry, not just at Lochless, but for a number of the neighboring old estates who'd sold away their own laundry women. And she had brokered a deal with my father, allowing her to split payments with him, and in that way some day purchase her own freedom. "Where will you go?" I asked. I was walking with her to the stables, for I had been enlisted in this partnership now as a driver.
"Farther than you," she said, smiling sardonically.
We loaded ourselves into one of the old chaises, sturdy, but dating back to my father's youth, and headed down the drive. At the juncture with the main road of the estate, I saw Sophia standing, wrapped in a shawl from her head down. I could see the little head of Carrie looking out. Thena told me to pull over, which I did. Then I stepped out of the cart.
"She coming?" I said to Thena. "Well, don't be so joyful," Sophia said. "Ben coming," said Thena, taking Carrie from Sophia, who now, not waiting for any assist, climbed into the back.
I got back into my seat, pulled on the reins to start up the horse, and asked,
"How long y'all been doing this?" "Quite a bit while you was out," said Sophia. "When I got back, I felt a need to make myself useful in some other way than before. Started giving Thena a hand with the washing till Caroline prevailed upon me, and then I had no more hands to give." "Got some things straight," Thena said. "Had our share of talks."
"About what?" I said.
"About you," Thena said.
I shook my head and blew out a dismissive breath through my teeth, and then all was quiet for a while, until we turned onto Hookstown Road and old memories began to spring forth from Thena.
"I had family all up and down here," she said. "Uncles, aunts, cousins. Had to know who I could marry and who I could not. There were so many associations. The old folks kept the memory, knew who was kin and who was not." "That is what they there for," said Sophia, "to hold the stories, keep the blood clean."
"But they all gone now," said Thena. "All the knowledge ones are gone, and we are reduced to our surmising upon a nose or eyebrow or a particular demeanor. Don't matter much, I guess. So few of us left. In another year like this, Elm will be dust."
He drove farther, stopping and picking up the washing from all the old mansions. The trees had all turned over and were now depositing themselves upon the floor of the woods in sheets of brown. The light of the season gave a ghostly glow to the old mansions, which had, only a year ago, heaved with their last energy and feeling. Most of them were like Lochless, stripped down to the barest of staffs, and I felt then that winter was not just marching on Virginia, but on Elm in particular, and would not be leaving. In the back I heard Carrie grow restless. Thena told me to pull over, and we watched as Sophia took Carrie in her arms, bouncing and singing, through a nearby field. Thena unwrapped some salt pork and shared it with me. Sophia came back with Carrie, still bouncing and singing.
"Who's been here since I've been gone? A pretty little girl with a blue dress on."
We drove on, and Thena considered her reminiscence.
"This path right here used to lead right up to Finney's place," she said. "I had a whole passel of people here. Had a aunt who used to cook for the first Finney himself. And in a time when y'all was but the smallest of peppers, they used to have the grandest kind of social down at the quarters here."
"I have heard," I said. "By my time, Finney the Second was mostly known for being so evil. Story was, he shot Pap Wallace, put him all to pieces because he would not submit to correction."
"Who you hear that from?" Thena asked.
"My Uncle Creon," I said. We were quiet for a while, riding along. It was late in the afternoon now, and we had one more pickup at the Granson place before turning back to Lockleff's.
"That was your uncle?" Thina asked.
"Sure was," I said. "He used to come down to the street at night, would hang near your mama's place for whatever scrap she had. It was not his best days. I remember him well."
"I remember him too," I said. "But he is all I remember of those times. I can see him at the door, and everything else is fog."
"Might be good," Sophia said. "No notion of what's lurking behind that fog."
"Ain't nothing good about it," I said. We stopped at the Granson place. Caroline was asleep now, and Sophia wrapped her in her shawl and made a hollow for her among the washing, which was tied in bedding sheets. She reached for a bundle left on the ground to hoist onto the chaise.
"I got it," I said. "Let me help," she said.
"You done helped plenty," I said,
with more heat in my words than I intended. Sophia's eyes widened, but she said nothing. She went back to the chaise, and we kept loading laundry. We got back with the sun still hanging just over the trees. She stepped down and said her goodbyes to Thina, and then she turned to me. It was only now that I saw that something had gone wrong.
"So this is what it is, huh?" she said.
She had Carrie wrapped on her back now, with her shawl. "What?" I said indignantly.
"This is who you are? This is how you come back? I don't know nothing. Don't you dare lie to me. Don't you dare. Not after you done come back. Don't you dare. You were supposed to be better. I told you, be better. I told you I wasn't trading no white man for a colored. And now look at you, stewing over what you don't own, over what no man should ever try to own. You were supposed to be better."
Then she was walking down the road, her anger made manifest in how she shook as she walked away. When we got back to the house, I unloaded the washing while Thina started on supper. Then I went to the kitchen, picked up my father's meal, and began to walk it into him. He wanted company for his supper. So I stood there and watched him eat as he interrogated me about the day. I fell back into myself until my face was a servile mask. After, I walked out down the secret staircase to Thina's quarters. We sat at her table and ate silently, as we always did. When we were done, she looked at me and said,
"You punishing that girl?"
Thina cut me off. "You punishing her?" I came back up and saw my father in the library, flipping through a volume. I went to the dining room and cleared his setting. Then I heated his cider and brought it to him and retreated upstairs to my room. The old toy horse I had carved for Georgie's son was on the mantel. I picked it up and ran my fingers across it. I thought on Sophia's words, the command to be better. I walked out of my room, down through the library, past my already dozing father, into the Warrens, and out through the tunnel. I walked down the long path past the orchards into the woods until I was down on the street. And I walked to the end where I found Sophia, seated out on the steps alone. Sophia shot me the coldest eye imaginable, and then she walked inside. I came to the door and looked in. I saw that Carrie was asleep on the bed. Sophia was looking away from me. I sat down next to her. "I am sorry," I said. "I am so terribly sorry for everything I have put upon you. I am so very sorry." I slipped my fingers between hers. All of my days spent dreaming of her, all of my hours spent wondering if she was lost out there, and all of my amazement at learning that she was down here, and all of my wondering again about what had become of her here, and about who she loved and who loved her, all of those hours of dreams and ghosts and blue whispers, all of it now was real, was right there between my fingers. "I want to be better," I said. "I am trying to be better." And Sophia pulled my hand to her lips and kissed it, and then turned to me and said,
"You want me to be yours, I understand. I have always understood it. But what you must get is that for me to be yours, I must never be yours. Do you understand what I'm saying? I must never be any man's.
Sophia. My Sophia. The notions I had, the lives I thought we might build. Notions and lives all in my head. All built on my soul, lonely ambitions. I sat there looking into her big sundrop eyes. She was so very beautiful as they said my mother was. And I knew, looking at her there, that those notions, those lives, had never considered Sophia as she knew herself to be. Because my Sophia had not been a woman to me. She had been an emblem, an ornament, a sign of someone long ago lost, someone whom I now glimpsed only in the fog, someone whom I could not save. Oh, my dear dark mother. The screams, the voices, the water. You were lost to me, lost. And there was nothing I could do to save you. But we must tell our stories, and not be ensnared by them. That is what I was thinking that evening in that old cabin down on the street. And that is why I reached into my pocket, pulled out the small toy horse I had collected from Georgie's, and put it in Sophia's hands. "For Carrie," I said. And now Sophia laughed quietly and said,
"She a little young for this high."
"I am trying," I said, smiling. "I am." Chapter 30. In the end, we, Thina, Sophia, young Carrie, and myself, were all that was stable at Lochless. Powers of blood bound us. Sophia was Nathaniel's chosen, and Carrie was her daughter. I was my father's son, and as for Thina, well, to my father she was the symbol of a bygone era. He had sold her children an act that, in his mind, was a turn in the road that marked the end of the Virginia he knew. He never quite said this, but my father avoided saying too much to Thina, and if he was walking the property and saw her coming, he would turn the other way. I think now that this was his ambition for her laundry runs, to somehow assuage the guilt of selling a woman's children on the racetrack. Guilt or not, it saved Thina, and together in those gray days, the four of us formed a kind of unit. We fell into a kind of routine. We took our meals together. After, I would see to my father and then walk Sophia and Caroline back to their quarters down in the street. One night, I was seeing them home, and Sophia said, speaking of Thina,
"You know she is getting old."
"She is," I said.
"It is a hard life, aye? A hard life on a woman, the laundry. The hauling, the rendering, the lie. I help out as I can, but it is hard. I am glad you came back. She need a break. Tell her to sit tight tomorrow. You and me, we can handle the washing. And we'll do the run on Monday, too."
When I got back, I told Thina our plan. She looked at me and then gave some manner of protest, relenting only after insisting on looking after Caroline while we worked. The next day was Sunday. Corrine was coming in to take my father off to church. With Hawkins attending them both, I could take up the extra labor. That night I lay in bed thinking of Thina and her plans. She still held out the hope of laundry money buying the last of her days in freedom. I held not to her plan, but to my own, the plan of the underground. Winter was upon us, the nights growing longer. I thought of Kessia and how her face would look when she found her mother was delivered, and I thought, even then, that I saw in that look not just the fulfillment of a promise, but the healing of some ancient wound in me. The washing was not easy work. We met in the early morning with the sky still black and illuminated by the pinprick of stars and the sliver of moon. We spent the first hour drawing up water from the well and filling our cauldrons. Then, while I gathered wood and got the fires going, Sophia separated the garments and searched for small tears. Then she delivered those few to Thina, whom
we were not wholly successful in keeping from work, for darning. With the fires going and the black cauldrons heating, we held up the garments and bedding and beat the soiling out of them. While Sophia finished the beating, I carried 3 large washing tubs out from the Warrens to the side of the house, where we were heating the water. The stars had now faded, and I could see the pale sliver of moon dissolving into the dark blue of those last small hours. When the tubs were in place, together with our work gloves on, we lifted the cauldrons and poured the hot water. And then, for the next few hours, we scrubbed, rinsed, and wrung, and then scrubbed, rinsed, and wrung twice more. We finished long after sunset. After hanging all the clothes, we walked over to the gazebo, as we had done in what seemed to me a lifetime ago. Our arms and backs were sore. Our hands were raw. We sat there in the silence of things for 20 minutes, and then walked back to eat with Thina.
"Not so easy," she said,
and our exhausted silence was the loudest affirmation imaginable. Afterward, I walked Sophia down to the street, and lingered as she washed and dressed Caroline for bed. I stepped outside and knocked my knuckles around